What is going on? Welcome to the Land Podcast this week. Boy, do we have a great episode. It's so great. We're actually making it a two-part episode, and this is the first session of it with Calvin. And Calvin is a very interesting guy. He started in the outdoor industry and is now a full-time real estate investor for multifamily, for buying and selling houses, for commercial buildings, and land. And putting these two episodes together, I guarantee there's going to be some things that you guys pick up that you haven't on the Land Podcast up to this point. So hope you guys really enjoy this episode. And in case you're brand new here, I'm going to do this really fast. The goal is very simple. It's to help 100 people buy their first piece of ground. If you're looking in the state of Illinois, give me a call. Happy to help you out if you're looking in an area of my expertise. Number two, if you want to get connected with someone I would consider doing business with, if I know someone where you're looking, I'm happy to make an introduction and you can make your decision from there. And number three, if you simply learn something from this that helps you take action confidently and buy that first farm, because all of these folks, no matter who you talk to, they all start with one farm, and a lot of times they're not anything big, they're not anything special, but it gets them going. And I think that is the point of this podcast, to help you take the plunge confidently, be sharp, and avoid some expensive mistakes. And a buyer's agent is going to help you throughout that process as well. And then also, exciting week for Exodus. We're going to be releasing the Lift 4K. We're going to do a pre-sale on that here this week, Thursday. Stay tuned to the Exodus email list and also our social, and we're going to announce the exact time. And we're going to be going live, answering all of your questions, and showcasing this brand new standard camera. It is awesome. It is going to be the best standard camera in the marketplace. I feel very confident with that. It's going to shoot native 4K video, a different battery source. And if you're an agent and you want the best videos for a listing, this is going to be the camera for that. I guarantee it. That's what I'm most excited about. And also, for anyone that just wants those incredible November videos of big bucks doing stuff in November during the rut, this is the camera for you. About the camera this Thursday evening, check it out. Check out our socials and be in the loop. And then also, if you have some arrows laying around, you don't know what to do with them, they're junk, they're scrap, they don't shoot worth a heck, good news, we have an interesting program going on right now for Exodus. Use the code TRADE to save 15% off our arrows. All you have to do is go to the website, pick out the bear shafts that you want, whether the MMT or the NIS, or if you want them tailored built to your setup, we're going to do that and ship them right to your door. And then use code TRADE, save 15% off. Once you get your box, you can throw in your old arrows and ship them back. So that is it. I hope you guys have a great week. Let's get right into it. Calvin, welcome to the Land Podcast. So excited to have you on here this morning.
Thank you for having me on, Jake. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we've been going back and forth here. I think you messaged originally probably like right before deer season, and then that's kind of a crazy time. Things get lost in the shuffle, and we've been talking here briefly, and you sent over some things you've done in the past year, and I'm excited to dive into all of that. But I'll give you the honor of introducing yourself to all the listeners.
Cool, yeah. I'm excited too. I mean, I think land and / whitetails is probably my favorite thing to talk about. So I'm full-time in real estate for the last probably 7 years, not as an agent, just as a investor, flip homes, own apartment buildings, own commercial, and own land. And kind of started out in the hunting, graduated high school in 2009, started out with buying a rental. Grand Rapids in West Michigan was very depressed at that time in terms of the real estate market. And by accident, it was kind of a good time to start. Although I didn't, I made all the wrong decisions and wrong moves, and learned through those hard times. So kind of had a small marketing firm, largely within the hunting industry, worked for Fourth Arrow for a couple of years. And then I think it was 2016 or 2017 that I went full time into my own real estate firm.
Yeah. And so for everyone listening too, there was, I'll call it an iconic Fourth Arrow social media ad where you're walking through the timber and talking about the Fourth Arrow camera arm. And so did you have the marketing bug and business? Obviously you have the business bug, but I mean, it modeled very similar to Dollar Shave Club, that ad that, you know, they grew to $1 billion company, and it's like the same formula. I just want to hear the backstory on that.
Yeah, it was a culture of the day. I don't know if I remember every detail about it. I believe I did script that ad, and it was controversial. It was controversial, I think, in our own office, and then it was controversial when it actually released. So it was unique. And yes, it did. I mean, it worked. I mean, it more worked in just the sense of grabbing attention and people looking into it. But there was, like, you know, people criticizing it, like, why are you throwing these parts in the woods? And it's like, obviously we're picking these things up. So yeah, it was fun to put together. I mean, that's probably one of the last ones I actually acted in or played the actor role. And it took us like, I don't know what it took us like four. It's like one clip. So it took us like 50-100 takes or something to actually say everything right and do everything right. So
that's really funny. But no, I remember seeing that, and it definitely caught a lot of traction, which is that was really cool. I remember that. So so backing up into 2009, you bought your first real estate property, and obviously right on the tail end of the financial crisis of 2008-2009. And so in hindsight, to your point, it was a really good purchase. So when you started with just one house, and you know, you sent over kind of what you have going on today, did you ever imagine as just a general roadmap, or was it one of those situations where you just got in and then just continued to learn and kept evolving and kept growing?
Yeah, it kept pivoting. I mean, I think, you're familiar with Bigger Pockets program. I mean, there was all these different points, like, you know, there's a certain point where you're like, okay, you know, rental homes are the dream. I want to own 1,000 rental units. And it's like, well, I never got there, you know, because the dream switched, and then it switched to, switched to multi, you know, apartment buildings. And then it switched to, and then I bought a commercial building and realized how much more I love dealing with one large tenant rather than, and great professional relationships rather than your typical residential tenant. So now, you know, now our biggest focus is probably acquiring. So we flipped 140 homes last year. We're trying to flip 200 homes this year. So we got about 100 guys in the field. So flipping homes is 80% of what we do. But however, probably the more important part is picking up the commercial real estate and the land, mm-hmm. the acreage. And that's kind of our long-term investment goals. You know, flipping homes is the job. Investing in commercial and land is the investment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to that. And you're doing that at a high level. And so just give a brief run through of kind of your portfolio right now, if you don't mind sharing. Like, it could be somewhat vague, just so listeners can mm-hmm. get an idea of, you know, you started with one home to what you're at today, and then maybe we can reverse engineer of how you got there and some mistakes that you made.
Yeah, so we've been selling a few apartment buildings, so I think we're down to about 200 residential units or 200 residential doors, maybe 220, and then we're probably up to, I think, about a dozen commercial buildings now. And usually that's like a 50,000 to 200,000 square foot manufacturing facility, or like a retail center. I mean, we've got like a retail center with like a Starbucks and a Chipotle, tenants like those. But mostly it's industrial manufacturing buildings. And then what we've really been doing for the last 5 years, we never really were officially flipping hunting land, but that's about 6 months ago. I hired Alan Messing, which would be a good guy for you to get to have in and dive into the weeds of flipping hunting land. But so we hired him about 6 months ago to actually head up our land division of our company. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing there is, like, we're going to be doing some. Really, two. It's you know, two motives. It's one, to continually grow the acreage. I mean, you say it all the time. Your guests say it all the time. Land, they're not making any more of it. And I mean, they are in some places. They're making more land in a few places, and it's extremely expensive to dump dirt in the ocean and make a little more land. And with all the restrictions on that and wetlands and stuff, like, there really isn't. You know, it's so. So we're buying land in Ohio, Indiana. We just put under contract, actually the Whitetail Properties agent, Kyle, in Wisconsin. We put a property under contract that we hope to be closing in a few weeks. You know, some of these like Ohio, we're targeting some of these like lower priced areas. So we're just trying to, you know, grow in acreage and then also produce hunting properties that are all prepped to the market, you know, that we can, you know, make a profit on and have a lot of fun hunting in the process.
Right. That's like talking with a lot of guys. It's like, obviously there, it's an investment. Absolutely. But it's probably the only investment I know that you can get so much joy out of and so much, so this, like whatever that's worth to some people, maybe it's worth a lot to some and maybe not as much to others, but you mentioned Ohio, Indiana, and Wisconsin. So, and really with the lack of inventory, I'm almost, when did you guys buy your first acreage? Cause I know you guys are pushing 1,000 acres now.
Yeah. I think this Wisconsin purchase, I think will roll us over 1,000 acres. I started kind of dabbling in little parcels, like probably in 2014, 15. I think the first time I bought a 77 acre parcel, which is probably one of my best land flips to date, I want to say it was like a 2018 purchase or 2019 purchase, and then sold it about 2 years or a year and a half later.
Was that Ohio?
That was Michigan. Okay. Yeah.
So everyone listening right now is wondering number one, how are you finding all these deals, right? Right. So like to find that many houses to flip and then even finding a strong buy in Wisconsin right now for the recreational side. I mean, is there a strategy? Is it just plain old fashioned due diligence and work?
Yeah. So, I mean, probably half our, when we flip homes, like 90% of our homes come off market or off market deals. So we have like, we kind of know marketing. We have our own marketing for homes. We don't really have that developed for hunting property. We've sent mailers. I don't know if we've had any mailers where it's been word of mouth. It's been agents. I mean, probably 60% of the land we've bought has been on market and 40% has been off market. And as you expand, I mean, agents will call you with, you know, deals. I mean, there's always people who don't want to list their properties, but are still in touch with an agent. And so the agent, I mean, one of the best pieces we bought in Ohio last year, the guy wasn't ready to list it. You know, I'm sure you've got this all the time with clients, like, you know, not ready to list it, not ready to sell. But the agent had said to him, like, hey, if I can get you this number in this range, you know, and the guy was like, you know, sure, go, you know, have somebody go walk it. So The agent had me walk it. We produced an offer. The guy accepted. You know, so in that sense, we're just coming in and, you know, kind of take the same strategy if we hold or flip it. And that's going to be to like assess the timber value, you know, make a whole habitat and hunting plan, assess all the wildlife, you know, that's there, develop neighbor relationships and, you know, it's all of the classic, things to improve a property for hunting. So Ohio, we have a home base, you know, we have a home farm with a house and barn that we kind of operate out of, you know, when we go down. Obviously everything we do in Michigan is usually within an hour of our, you know, where we live in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. How did that, what tripped your trigger on the Wisconsin farm?
Wisconsin is probably my favorite place to hunt in the world.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So way back in the day, we had a Michigan Whitetail Pursuit was a DVD series, with, Sean Vanderwall. I started Wisconsin Whitetail Pursuit, which ran for like 4 years, just was a DVD series, did well, it, you know, wasn't selling DVDs, isn't a highly profitable place to be, but you know, it's a lot of fun. And we did a lot of public land hunting. So we would often, so from that time on, I mean, for probably 7-8 years in a row, I would go out to places like either like, River Falls or Richland Center or, you know, some small town Wisconsin place, you know, grab a hotel or Airbnb and hunt public ground. So I rarely hunt Michigan public ground. Don't really enjoy it. there was just, I think Wisconsin public ground is pretty saturated. now probably more than it was even when I was hunting it like 7-8 years ago, but we would just hunt, you know, MFL or public land in Wisconsin, and I had so many run-ins with big deer, and yes, I shot a couple mature deer. You know, I shot the, you know, the busted up like 11 point that doesn't score well, and you know, messed up on the 180 inch giants that I have no proof of seeing. So, but I just love the terrain. Both of Southeast Ohio and like, you know, Central West Wisconsin. I just love that mix of agriculture, you know, with just rocky cliffs and outcroppings and ridges. And so I prefer that probably to like just straight up flat ag or, mm-hmm. or just big woods hunting.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. And I guess, you mentioned your first recreational farm being one of your best buys, and that's something that I have seen with clients I've helped purchase their first farm. And I don't know what that is, but a lot of those folks, you know, whether it's just getting into the market and it ends up being their springboard to, you know, other opportunities down the road, I see that to be a common theme with a lot of the first time land buyers I've helped, mm-hmm. that first buy being really good. And, so that's just kind of my pitch to someone that's been on the sidelines. Like, you're saying your first one was one of your best, and I can rattle off a bunch of clients that I know offhand that their first farm was, you know, an exceptional buy. And I don't know if there's a mix of beginner's luck or if you're just so, so in tune with what exactly you want. And obviously that it changes over time. But, so one question that I think a lot of people have is, okay, so this is a lot of real estate, a lot. And what is your strategy? Because this is a question I get pretty often. People email in, so they say, okay, yeah, that's great. I bought my first farm, then I bought a second farm, and it's hard for me to stair step up with whatever income they have. And so obviously you have a lot of legs to your business and a lot of streams of income. What would be a piece of advice for someone that is a dual income household and they bought, you know, they're at step number two or step number three in terms of the land journey, and they want to get to the next larger bump in acreage, but they're looking at it's like, man, how do I do this? What do you have any advice for someone like that? Make more money?
I do. I mean, so one of the we targeted Southeast Ohio because I wanted our dollar to go farther, right? So if you're trying to buy land, this is what's prevented me from being in Wisconsin up to this point, is that 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 grand an acre cost of land. We bought, you know, we're buying pieces in Southeast Ohio for 50 grand, for 70 grand. So like, you know, I mean, we're talking down payments, you know, so sometimes we'll buy it cash and then refinance it later because that's the client, you know, the seller wants a cash offer. But, you know, but other times, you know, I mean, think of one of the parcels. I had three buddies kill a nice buck on a 35 acre parcel I bought this summer. So bought this 35 acre parcel. It was listed for 99,000. This is where the agent relationships, you know, go away. Is the agent, you know, his client was, you know, they didn't want to like price drop it right away, but his client was very motivated. And I said, you know, I walked up the first ridge and said, I don't like this. Got back in my truck. And usually I don't do that. There was no timber value. Didn't like how it set it up for hunting. Didn't like that it was 30 some 5 acres for 99,000, and got back in my truck, went home. I was just on a trip in Ohio to renovate the house with my guys down there. And, you know, it got to be that conversation of, well, what price would you be interested in? And I was like, shoot, I should have actually walked that parcel instead of, and keep in mind, I mean, it was 90 degrees and I'm hiking up ridges you know, like you get demotivated pretty quickly. About the 20th tick that you flick off, it's like, all right, I don't feel like, you know, walking, you know, everybody has a tendency to buy ground on better weather days. I'm confident of that. So
I agree.
But anyway, so I was like, well, I'll buy it at 70. And then we ended up settling at 72,000 and bought it. But yeah, my down payment on that was like with Midwest Farm Credit, I think was like $10,000. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about your average household income of what, like how fast can you save $10,000? Well, my guess is that people can save that pretty fast. So, the second piece of advice I would say is go sell that first or second farm, you know, like put those improvements in, and instead of getting super attached to it or emotional about it, go put it on the market, put it on the market for a price that you would be happy with and see if it goes and roll that, 1031 into your next farm.
Yeah. You bring up a very key thing, especially when it comes to land, emotion. And a lot of people are emotional when they buy their first farm, and everyone I've talked to that has grown into something similar to what you're talking about. You can't fall in love with your first farm because ultimately it ends up being your springboard, and you know, you saved up your down payment, you have that basis, and then hopefully you have some profit, and then you're able to 1031 and go find something else. But I think it's the emotion of buying something. Usually people are nervous or scared, and then people are emotional or scared when they sell it of, is it going to be better than what I already have, or am I making a mistake? And so how have you personally just built up a callus of that with just doing so much general real estate, or do you just look at it as, hey, it's a business transaction, and for where I'm at and where I want to go, this is what has to happen?
I'm subject to all those same things too. I mean, you know, I'm this Wisconsin piece we're under contract with, like a month ago, 3 weeks ago when we went under contract with it, we talked about it like a 5.9% interest rate, and now rates just ticked back up, and now we're talking about like a 6.8% interest rate, and it's just like, you know, just the math is getting worse on it. So my emotions are coming into play, and so there's always frustrations, there's always emotions. You know, I probably 10% of properties I regret, you know, buying.
Why would you regret a purchase? So what, you bought a farm, so there's one that has to be at the top of mind right now. So maybe share why you regret buying a specific piece and what went wrong, or what, you know, why wasn't it what you thought it was?
I mean, two things come to mind right away. I mean, the two things that I think would make me after the fact not excited about a purchase, you know, are just number one, neighbors. You buy ground, neighbors are bad. You know, that's a killer. And second one is just, you know, put in the time and money and it just does not produce big deer, you know, like, you know, I've had those. I mean, it's surprising what does produce big deer and what doesn't, you know, and like my home farm in Ohio, there's some, you know, for example, I've got some Amish neighbors who I really like them. They're great people. And guess what? They shoot a lot of deer. So like my home farm this year, I have a, you know, it's 108 acres. I would love to walk out, you know, like I did the previous year, you know, roll out of bed in the morning, you know, 80 yards down the driveway, pop up in a stand, and I'm in one of, you know, the best places I can be to shoot a big deer. Well, this year, I mean, there just wasn't a big deer there. So, that's why I love the quantity game. Maybe it is like, I'd rather own those, unless I can actually be on like 600-800 acres, which I haven't been able to, you know, amass that in one spot. I'd rather have 30s and 50s and, you know, all over the place, especially in a place like Southeast Ohio, like Central West Wisconsin. Here in Michigan, I mean, it's like the hunting is definitely worse than those places. And yeah, I'm not looking for 30 acres here because it'll be surrounded by 10 and 20 acre parcels and there will be a guy in every tree. So
yeah. 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 That's a really big thing. And I think, neighbors are, it's funny how this works. Every time someone buys a piece, and this has been my experience of like it sounds bad, but they buy the farm, and then probably the second or third thought they have Onyx open and they're like, oh, I wonder if I can buy this, I can start piecing all these things together. And I think it's human nature of expanding, you know, whatever you have. But, so neighbors and just the fact of maybe just a piece doesn't produce what it's thought. So did you, a piece that you regret buying, for example, have you sold any of those, or are you just holding on to them and riding out the storm?
I mean, one thing I love doing with like, even on a piece that's like in a downhill in your mind, is I love buying pieces with sufficient road frontage to do splits. So, you know, I will take my cash out of that piece step by step. And I've had just great success doing that. So, I mean, the reason I've been able to grow is not, you know, I mean, hopefully there's some smart decisions in there, but a huge reason I've been able to grow is just by the basics of of, you know, just all the simple things is, you know, is buying the piece right, getting the timber value, splitting it into two or three parcels. You know, so there's pieces where I'll wind up with having essentially free land after I do my split and getting all my cash out of that piece and leaving a piece. So now I've got a smaller piece, but it's close to free. You know, I mean, it's, yeah, so I have sold, I mean, there's one piece I sold in Michigan here where that's what I kind of just leveled, not like it had tillable. I sold off the tillable this whole time the market's rising. I had bought it right. It was funny, on the last day, the morning I was going to list it, I shot a good buck. For the first time in 2 years, I shot a good buck, really the first good buck I saw on the parcel, and shot it. So we listed it that morning with a success picture of that deer that I killed that morning. So, you know, so, and that probably, that picture probably made me a little bit of money. Like it wasn't a, you know, it was 125-inch 8-point beautiful 3-year-old deer, which is a trophy here. You know, so yeah, I don't know if a roundabout way that got to answer your question, but you know, a lot of times we're buying a rundown farmhouse on that, you know, with 35 acres, you know, we parcel off that farm. We do a lot of, I mean, that's where the home flipping business comes into play, is, you know, we're parceling off that house on 2 to 5 acres, selling that separate. Usually that land and that house are worth more separately, as those are separate buyers, not, you know, it's a higher value to split those things up. So, which I mean, I hate splitting land too. It's the kind of the nature of every parcels. It's rare when parcels get bigger, you know, they usually get smaller, but so we're doing that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a really good key takeaway. And there was Cody Bittner, he was on an episode here recently, and that was the first piece that he bought. And another example of, you know, he felt like he did really good on that first piece, and it was a farmhouse. Someone bought the farmhouse and then he bought the acreage. Mm-hmm. The people that bought the house didn't want the additional acreage. And I mean, I feel like you're kind of in a unique situation too, which is great to have I assume you have to have a team of contractors and a bunch of resources to go in and get that type of project, like update or renovate a, you know, older farmhouse in a quick fashion. Like how many, is this a perfect adjacency to what you have going on for this too? I have to imagine.
Right. Yeah. And at the same time, you know, if you didn't have that, you know, still doing the split and selling the fixer upper farmhouse as is still a money making, you know, in generally, you know, if you bought the piece right, it's still, most of those people don't want to do that. Most of you say, why doesn't the original seller just don't do that? I don't find most agents want to, you know, push their seller into doing that. Most sellers don't want to go through all that extra work doing that. So there's some low hanging fruit there with when you see a house on a parcel and you desire that parcel for hunting. Like usually that's, we've been pretty easily be able to make those things work out, be profitable even without fixing the house or call the right contractors to do that.
Yeah. So. So as far as how do you manage debt load in general? So, or I guess, what have you learned about managing debt load, especially with the interest rates environment that we're in now? Obviously, the Fed says they're supposed to be lowered, you know, throughout this year, and who knows?
Yeah, not looking like it.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like, I swear they just said that to boost consumer confidence. But yeah, that's a side tangent. But anyways, what's some advice that you have on for folks to manage debt load?
Yeah, I mean, I like running. You know, like again, we've been. The business has grown because of all the market appreciation. So, you know, we haven't done a lot of like cash out refinance to, you know, thing, but on the, you know, on a lot of those, you know, we buy a piece for, I think one piece we bought for 130 grand right down the road, actually from that $72,000 piece. So we buy it for 130 grand. It's all right. I mean, our down payment's like 20,000, 25,000 in that range. And I mean, we're going to be getting a $45,000 timber check, you know, here soon on that. So, I mean, you almost have to be careful because you can quickly, you know, I mean, I can buy up a lot more land if I want and by just roll, you know, taking that timber money, rolling it in the next down payment. But yeah, what you have to watch out for is what is that monthly payment. And so one thing we're looking at is, I mean, we've got a, you know, like the Wisconsin piece has a very nice little furnished house on it. It was like a vacation house before, so we'll probably turn that into an Airbnb, you know, and get you know, we've got little chunks of tillable everywhere. So kind of just making every dollar count in the revenues you can pull off these parcels. But, you know, hunting, you know, us hunting our own parcels doesn't, you know, there's no revenue there. So, you know, we are selling parcels to make money. And I think, you know, we buy them. Even last year, I got a piece in, we bought a piece, really had really bad access in Ohio, 200 acres for $289,000. So it's, you know, $1,400 an acre, about as cheap as you're going to get land anywhere in the United States, I think. And, great hunting, had two buddies shoot bucks on that piece this year. Plus a couple more, missed deer and, just a great piece, but extremely trashy area. Like, I mean, if I can say this, the worst trailer park ever to, you know, drive through to this piece. Well, on the other side of this piece, there's a really nice neighborhood. We just, 30 acres came on market that butts up in our piece. And now we have like beautiful access, you know, to this piece after buying that additional access. You know, so, and honestly, I mean, I'm emotionally attached to this piece and we're probably going to list it for sale because the money, you know, like I think the profit's there and then we'll go pursue that. So yeah, probably, again, probably going off on a tangent there, but,
it's really important because I think ultimately when you look at a piece, it's like, how can we force appreciation? How can we make it better? Obviously the biggest deterrent of this piece was you had to drive through, less than savory scenery and then, okay, well, now you have two-sided access, even if one side isn't too pretty, but now you have better access. And I think that's a really creative thing. And I think a lot of pieces could go from maybe a 4 to an 8 if you're able to buy even a 5-acre sliver that butts up to it and you can get two-sided access. Right. And it opens up the door to a lot of other opportunities too on how, if you did decide to split it or, right. Or you just have a piece with access. And this is something I've noticed with a lot of people I've talked to. I feel as buyers, as land buyers across the board, and this is the same thing for whitetail hunting, the same thing for everything in the world, where people get more sophisticated with more information. And people will scrutinize a farm pretty heavily if the access is bad, and I understand why. And I felt like before, you might have been able to get away with not having great access because people didn't value it as much as what it is today. Like I have a handful of clients that say, I only want something with east access, southeast access, period. Yeah. I was like, you know, there's ways to work around that, but that's their hard rule. And so,
well, yeah.
So you're limiting some buyers just by them having that mindset, and whether that's right or wrong, I don't know, but that's a conversation I'm having more and more with folks.
That's funny. Cause I have the problem in Michigan where like, I better be ready to hunt every north wind because I own all these parcels that are on the same side of the road with the same ag and wood setup. So I've got like a million north wind tree stands, you know? Uh-huh. So I just like, I wish the whole season was a north wind. So that's interesting. And we coming in it from like a real estate investment standpoint, we often won't, you know, look at like, we see the price per acre as like number one. And then we buy this crap land, if you want to call it, and say, all right, where can a food plot go? Where can we make a trail system that allows for hunting a variety of wind directions? Where can we force a building site, you know, here? We do a lot of, you know, one of our greatest contacts in Ohio is an Amish excavator, and he rents a dozer every time we want work done. And I mean, this dude works, I mean, I get him on trail cameras at 2 a.m. with running his excavator around. I don't know what it's just so you get these. Yeah, he's amazing contact. And I will not share his contact information either. So
you don't want to be too busy. Yeah. It's like a good contractor. You don't want to share their number to everyone, but that's honestly,
so he's been amazing for us. And you get, a couple of these good vendors. I mean, we have a great logger down there now. Yeah. Great logging contact, great excavator. So you get those and you can have, you know, we can do a lot of property development in a matter of a couple of weeks.
I think that, like that's the team you want to assemble, right? Whether it's a good forester or a good logger or a good dirt work contact, like that's the that's the dream team if you're looking to improve a parcel in a good fashion. And so when you're looking at something like, doing some of those projects, was there a learning curve on pricing that stuff out, or did you have an idea how much it would cost? And was it more than what you thought, less than you thought, or what's been the learning curve there?
Yeah, there's definitely been a learning curve. I mean, some of that soil is tough to grow in anything. So we'll put money into seed in what we think will be a beautiful food plot, and then it's a disaster. And then, so now we're relocating to like a wetter, you know, more of like a area with a natural spring that's or a bottom instead of a top to try to make the, you know, food work. Specifically in Southeast Ohio, everything has been more affordable than it is up by us. So pricing has been great, honestly. There's always surprises. I mean, like right now we want to put in a well in this Wisconsin piece, and like a well usually costs $10,000, you know, here eight to 12,000 for your average well. Well, by the time they hit water there, I mean, and the rules for wells in Wisconsin, it's like, it's going to be like a $35,000, you know, well, and that's a couple of vendors have bid that. So it's not like we're getting hosed on one vendor. So, you know, there's things like that where, yeah, we get a little shell shocked on, you know, and can make some buying mistakes on that. But, yeah, we're not dealing with our property development plan. We rarely will spend more than like 10 grand on a property. Usually we're spending like, you know, $3,000 to $6,000 on a full property development plan, mm-hmm. which will involve chainsaw work, you know, a couple grand worth of excavator trail system work. You know, a lot of home, you know, that 35 acres had like a trailer, just a destroyed trailer home on it. So, you know, paying to remove that, things like that, and cleaning up the property.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes, yeah, those are all very true things. And do you think that just the locality of where that is, like, I would imagine dirt work, I always encourage people to get bids on that, because where you're at in the country, that's going to vary. If you're in a lower income area, it's probably going to be more affordable. If you're in a metro area, whether it's right or wrong, it's going to be more expensive, even though it's the same kind of work.
Yeah. I think we're like, I think he's, I don't know what he's billing us for dozer work. I think it's like $60 an hour for running a dozer. So
yeah, there's a like skid work up here is substantially more than that, which is crazy. So how far of a drive is that for you to, from Michigan to where you're like your home base for Ohio?
Yeah. Six and a half hours. Yeah. The place we just bought in Wisconsin, 6.5 hours. We've just had one property in Indiana is like 5.5 hours. And then the Ohio is 6.5 hours. And yeah, I think we have 6 or 7 properties there now. Probably should have a couple more by hunting season as well. So Ohio is our main, you know, main plan for growing an acreage and, you know, flipping a few parcels as well.
Mm-hmm. Is that six and a half hour drive, does that get old, or since you have a place to crash there, it's not as bad? Because this is a question I get often, and obviously it's dependent on the person, but if you're, let's say you want to do a day trip, I feel like 2 hours is about a good radius. What are your thoughts?
I agree. Yeah, okay. I am married with four kids, and I can't, you know, the kids are getting to ages where, like, I think this spring break we're gonna, you know, go down there as a family trip. And that's exciting because we have not done that yet. It's pretty limited when I can go down there. I mean, to probably go down probably 3 times to hunt. So it's kind of becomes my hunting vacation, right? Like, you know, in Michigan, I try to work all of my hunting around work. If I'm going to Ohio, I'm going hunting there for a week, and it's deer camp. You know, there's 8 or 10 of us there. It's, you know, it's a great time. So for hunting wise, I mean, the trip is insignificant. For like property prep and planning wise, I mean, that's why it's important to have the boots on the ground. For like our logger will actually go walk a property, and he's not only building a logging quote, like, so a property hits the market, we trust our agent enough and our logger enough, we will buy that property without ever seeing it. Mm-hmm. So we're not going, some of the properties we buy, we're not going down there to actually see them. Mm-hmm. You know, which I mean, I would totally, if you're buying your first or second farm, you're probably not going to do that. But we trust these guys enough to tell us about the neighbors, tell us, you know, about the road frontage, accessibility, you know, the deer sign, the timber value. I mean, we trust them on all those things. So that part of it makes it easy. But, you know, I'm probably going to go down there four or five times a year. Alan is probably going down there seven or eight times a year. So,
yeah. Is there a punch list or a mental checklist for someone that wants to buy their first farm? Obviously you have more than a few under your belt, but what someone listening, they're thinking, okay, I have some money saved up and, you know, interest rates are they are what they are. What advice or mental checklist would you provide them to run through? And I know we covered a lot of these things, but if anything jumps out.
Yeah. I mean, I've always encountered a lot of people that are just never willing to take that first step. And I think owning a small farm that doesn't check all your boxes is better than owning no farm at all. So, I mean, I think that's the first thing is like, just get into something. And that experience will teach you what you actually want and need, to be able to make your purchasing will become so much smarter on number three and four. And your comfort with the whole transaction process will be there. Everything's so unpredictable, neighbors, the place where I think we're gonna have neighbor problems, we don't. And then the place that I think is going to be great neighbor relationships, all of a sudden we've got some big issues. So, it's hard to forecast a lot of things. Advice for somebody buying out of state, again, I think it's more about just getting, your agent is probably the most important, probably the most important thing to give you all of the, an agent that actually gives you wisdom, is probably step one.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a great piece of advice. Obviously you've worked with a bunch of agents all across the board. What do you think for someone that's listening that wants to interview an agent and to see if they're a good fit? What are some questions that you ask? Like, let's say you want to buy in West Virginia or whatever other state that you haven't gone to yet. What's your process of finding your go-to guy?
It's a mixed bag. So like, we will use multiple agents in one area just because we're buying a lot of stuff and they all kind of have their fortes. I will be pretty quick to call up the listing agent on a parcel that hits, I'm on it day one and it appears underpriced. I'm usually going to go straight to the listing agent and make that call. If it's not, my favorite there, I've got a great agent in Southeast Ohio. Josh Henry is his name. And he's just such a resource on contact. So I think I would almost start with that is first, what are your goals for the property? You almost want, if you're pursuing like a hunting property with investment, you want the guy to hunt. You want him to be fit. I've had agents like take me, halfway up the first hill and be huffing and puffing and they can't guide me through the rest of the property, and they don't want me to go I've had a lot of not great experiences with agents who, don't know, act like they know a little bit about hunting. They don't know a thing about hunting and act like they know about the land values. And it's clear that they don't. So, how to interview? That's tough. I think interviewing them about, timber value is always a big thing to me. So interviewing them about, you'll quickly get a feel. I think when you start asking questions about timber value, about their hunting, about their transactions, I think you'll quickly, it's almost more of a gut feel thing than probably anything else. The agents who hustle, I feel like they'll always be in touch with you, sending you stuff, even off market leads. Kind of having an agent that you hopefully be friends with and not, but that you don't annoy them all the time is probably a good path to be on. It varies so much in what kind of parcel you're pursuing. Like if you're pursuing a parcel to build a home on and hunt like that, to me, that's a different, whole different set of things that you're kind of looking for. If you're just looking to get to pay at market or under market pricing for a hunting parcel, where for you the main goal is shooting a big deer on. Like I just really want, I don't want to walk that parcel with an agent who just doesn't know how to hunt deer. I want to be able to talk through things with him. So, and those agents can be kind of hard to find. So,
Yeah, I think that's all really good feedback. Here's a question for you. Would you rather buy a great farm at a fair price or a fair farm at a great price?
I'll buy the fair farm at a great price all day long.
Really? Really? Yeah. Okay. What about a bad farm at a great price or a great farm?
I like that too.
So what about some things that you can't necessarily fix? Like, so when I think of a bad farm, I'm thinking bad access, bad neighbors, and the
bad neighbors one. If it's clear that they're bad neighbors, I'm going to struggle with that one a little bit. But then it wasn't just the trailer park on this one parcel. I mean, the other neighbors were bad. I walked up to the one house to see if we could get access through their parcel. There's a legal easement through this other parcel. And I walked up to this sketchy house. I did not see all the dogs on the porch that were laying there nicely sleeping. I mean, the lady I talked to was high as a kite. All the dogs are growling at me. And, you know, when she said, you know, whatever, her husband or whatever will be home at some point to talk to him. But then she made some comments like, you might not want to talk to him. I'm like, I don't care if we have an easement through this parcel. I'm not using it. You
right.
Know? So it's just like.
And you still bought that. That's the piece you bought for like.
That's the piece we bought. Yeah. I can't help myself when something's that's good of a deal. And now we own access in a beautiful neighborhood on the other side. And it worked out. But, you know, again, that's not a parcel I'm buying to build my own home on, which is very different. You know, I would never buy that piece to build my home on. But I'm going to, you know, if the price is really right, I'm going to take some risks on that.
There you guys have it. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode with Calvin. Next week, we're going to have the part two of this conversation, and there's even more great insight and tips and some things that he's learned over the years that you can implement in your own land journey wherever you are and whatever that is to you. Hope you guys have a great rest of your week. Use the code TRADE to save 15% off an arrow order. Get them for tack, get them for turkey season, get them for the spring so you can start practicing for this fall. And then check out the Lift 4K live stream. You're gonna want to check this camera out. You're gonna want to save some money on the pre-order. Have a great week. See ya.